history, providing the United States and its proxies an opening to enact regime change.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض بَعْضَكُمْ فَوْقَ بَعْضٍ دَرَجَاتٍ لِيَبْلُوَكُمْ فِي مَا آتَاكُمْ إِنَّ رَبَّكَ سَرِيعُ الْعِقَابِ وَإِنَّهُ صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Top stories this hour. Russia announces new retaliatory measures against Moscow-based British media after London imposes sanctions on Russian news outlets. Yemen's former Saudi-backed president announces the establishment of a presidential leadership council and transfers his powers to it. Also ahead, Syria condemns Israeli forces' repeated attacks on Palestinians across the occupied territories, calling on the international community to take immediate action to stop the regime's crimes. Welcome to your world news, coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. 43 days into Russia's military offensive in Ukraine, there are reports of fresh Russian strikes against the cities of Mariupol and Kharkiv. Ukrainian officials say they are trying to help residents to evacuate Mariupol. The port city remains one of the worst affected areas, with its mayor warning that the situation there has now gone beyond a humanitarian disaster. Calls for evacuation are also underway in the eastern Luhansk region, where an acid tank exploded on Tuesday. Kyiv and pro-Russian forces are blaming each other for the incident. Other developments in eastern Ukraine include Russia's bombardment of the city of Kramatorsk, where an empty school was damaged. Meanwhile, Russia says its guards have been targeted in Kursk, a city located on its western border with Ukraine. Russia says it'll take further measures against Moscow-based British media after London imposed sanctions against Russian news outlets. Russia's foreign ministry spokesperson says the move is in response to, quote, British oppression of Russian media. This after London announced sanctions on 14 Russian people and entities, including the state media organizations behind RT and Sputnik news channels. Spokesperson emphasized that symmetrical measures against British media in Russia, quote, have been and will be taken. Russia blocked the website of Britain's BBC on March 16 in what was described by Moscow as the beginning of its response to West's information war. Iran's foreign minister has reiterated the Islamic Republic's opposition to the war in Ukraine, calling for a political solution to the ongoing crisis. Hossein Amir Abdullahian also rejected the West's policy of imposing sanctions on other countries. He made the comments in a phone call with Hungarian Foreign Minister Peter Szijjártó. The call came after the recent general election in Hungary, in which Prime Minister Viktor Orban clinched a landslide victory. Tehran had previously said that the Ukrainian crisis is rooted in the expansionist policy of the U.S.-led NATO military alliance. Record disinterest in the French election may have taken a dramatic turn. New polls show the far right is now in a dead heat with the incumbent Emmanuel Macron. Many have pointed to Macron's lack of engagement in the campaign as a reason for his lost lead. Rami Mazahiri has more from Paris.
The latest voter polls in France have shown an almost total evaporation of a once sizable lead for President Emmanuel Macron. His edge over 2017's far-right runner-up, Marine Le Pen, is now down to just 3 points in a hypothetical second round, making the race a dead heat. France goes to the ballot box for the first round in just a few days on April 10th. Recent missteps by Macron may have alienated a French electorate which featured a 40% undecided rate just last week. Macron is being openly accused of trying to run from his record by hiding behind the unrest in Ukraine. He has refused to join any debate before the second round vote and has barely campaigned in France. With Macron's refusal, there was no typical first-round debate between the 11 presidential hopefuls. Instead, every candidate sat down for a highly anticipated televised grilling from journalists, all except Macron. His decision has come under harsh scrutiny as being anti-democratic.
It just shows how much Macron is just like all the other politicians, thinking only of himself. He knows that he did not implement the change that he'd promised, and that's why he can't face anyone. I may submit a blank ballot or vote for the riskiest candidate. That may be the only way to change things.
Macron, who did not hold his first press conference until more than 2 years into his term, has long been criticized as displaying a monarchical aloofness and an authoritarian style of governance. The election campaign has been dominated by xenophobia, which then created major disinterest and now worries of record abstention. With the left still running in third place, a candidate with many far-right policies seems certain to take office.
The right wing has been exploded into different sections, and both Macron's section and Le Pen's section are stable. 2017 destroyed the other parties and also the influence of society's intermediaries, such as unions and NGOs. And maybe we'll say later that this was a bad thing, but I'm not really interested in this election until the second round.
The huge recent victory of Le Pen's counterpart in Hungary has many wondering if polls have similarly underestimated the right nationalist candidate in France. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris. No.
Yemen's former president Abd Rabbah Mansour Hadi says a presidential leadership council has been formed and that his authority and powers have all been transferred to that council. The council will reportedly be in charge of leading ceasefire negotiations with the Yemeni Ansarullah movement. Hadi was absent from the recent consultations that were held in Riyadh by the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, with Yemeni media speculating that the Saudi regime was planning to dismiss him. Some sources had even suggested that Saudi officials had banned Hadi from holding any meetings or giving interviews to media. Back in 2015, Hadi, a close ally of Riyadh, resigned and fled to Saudi Arabia amid political strife and conflict in Yemen. That prompted the kingdom to intervene militarily to bring him back to power. But the Saudi-led coalition has been facing its stiff resistance from the Yemeni army and Ansarullah fighters for 7 years. The two sides have now agreed to a 2-month truce. Political analyst Yusuf Mowry believes the establishment of the council is just another move by Saudi Arabia to establish legitimacy for the former Yemeni administration.
There is no ceding of power. There is no presidential council. There is no quote-unquote legit Yemeni president as far as the Sana'a government is concerned. Abd Rabbah Mansour Hadi cannot cede power if he simply does not have power. In fact, Abd Rabbah Mansour Hadi's regime, they wouldn't even be able to issue a speeding ticket to an 80-year-old grandma, let alone dictate the political policies of the country. This is as far as the Yemeni people are concerned and the Sana'a government, because what's clear is that those who are able to exert any type of influence are the parties that are on the ground. is Ansarullah backed government, and the forces loyal to Saudi Arabia in the province of Madib and the province of Taiz. These are the only acting parties in the country. According to Ansarullah and according to a lot of their officials who are tweeting on Twitter, you know, this war is between two parties, and that is the Sana'a government led by Ansarullah and Saudi Arabia. And they view this as just another plan, another plot, another scheme by Saudi Arabia to try to somehow, some way gain leverage and try to establish some type of legitimacy for the regime of Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi.
The Saudi-led coalition seizes another Yemeni-bound fuel ship despite a two-month truce brokered by the United Nations. The Yemen Petroleum Company says the seizure of the oil vessel Daytona is in violation of the ceasefire agreed before the holy month of Ramadan. The company says the vessel had been inspected and obtained a UN clearance to enter the Yemeni port, but it says the tanker was forced to change its route and taken to a port in Saudi Arabia's Jizan region. This brings to three the number of fuel ships that have been confiscated by Riyadh since last year. Yemen is grappling with a deteriorating humanitarian crisis due to a relentless bombing campaign and blockade by Saudi Arabia along with some of its regional allies since 2015. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed and millions more displaced over the past 7 years. Moving on, Syria has condemned Israeli forces' repeated attacks on Palestinians across the occupied territories, calling on the international community to stop the regime's crimes immediately. In an official statement, the Syrian Foreign Ministry called Israel's acts of aggression against the Palestinian people a crime that contravenes the international law and relevant UN resolutions. Reaffirming its support for Palestinian people, Syria called on the international community to fulfill its responsibility toward them. The statement came as the regime in Tel Aviv continues its crackdown on Palestinians during the holy month of Ramadan. The regime's forces have arrested a large number of Palestinians in occupied East al-Quds and have frequently desecrated Al-Aqsa or Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Palestinian resistance movements have warned Israel against its acts of aggression, particularly during the month of Ramadan. Israel has imprisoned more than 9,000 Palestinian children in less than a decade. The Palestinian Prisoners Society says over 160 Palestinian children are currently in Israeli jails and subjected to different sorts of torture and abuse. In a report published earlier on the occasion of Palestinian Children's Day, the rights groups said Palestinian minors in Israeli jails are living under harsh and unhygienic conditions and deprived of their basic needs. The report has also offered evidence of Israel lowering the age of detention for Palestinian youths. The society is critical of international organizations and rights groups for their inaction on the detention of Palestinian children, a historically common practice of the Israeli regime. And the Israeli Prime Minister's party has lost its majority in parliament after a key lawmaker quit the ruling coalition. Chairwoman of the ruling coalition, Idit Selman, has, in a surprise move, resigned over a religious dispute. Her resignation has left the alliance with only 60 seats, effectively ending its parliamentary majority. Opposition figures have welcomed her move. The issue has also raised the possibility of new elections, less than a year after Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's cabinet took office. If that happens, it will be Israel's fifth elections in more than 2 years. Bennett's coalition, which was formed last year to unseat Benjamin Netanyahu, consists of 8 political parties. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran blames the West for failing to condemn Israel's acts of sabotage against the Islamic Republic.
The Zionist regime produces fake documents, carries out acts of sabotage, including industrial sabotage and terrorist operations. Unfortunately, such acts not only are not condemned or confronted, but are welcomed. Naturally, this is a battle between wrong and right, which remains in place. We follow our goals and will not back down.
Islami also touched upon the issue of cooperation between Tehran and the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. He said Iran handed over documents related to outstanding issues to the watchdog on March 20th. He added the body is still reviewing the documents and its representatives will probably travel to Iran for further talks and preparing a final report. Iran demands the IAEA end its investigations into uranium particles the agency claims have been found at 3 undeclared sites. Last month, Iran and the IAEA agreed to a 3-month plan to resolve the issue arising from such claims. Political commentator David Yahubian says a review of Israeli officials' words and deeds on a daily basis shows that the regime is bent on torpedoing the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA.
It's clear to any observer that, and I mean of not just the process, the JCPOA, the U.S. pullout, maximum pressure, et cetera, but Israel's deeds and its words almost on a daily basis, that Israel is determined to wreck the JCPOA, to either say ruin the agreement or to hinder the return by the signatories to full compliance. And so it has engaged in repeated acts of terrorism, repeated acts of industrial sabotage. It has produced troves of fake documents. And most importantly, again, it has repeatedly threatened to take military action, direct kinetic action against Iran's legal nuclear energy, civilian nuclear energy facilities.
Iran has rejected as biased and inaccurate some Western media allegations on the International Atomic Energy Agency's latest report on Tehran's nuclear activities. Iran says the report confirms that it had informed the agency before removing some of its centrifuge manufacturing equipment to the nuclear facility in Natanz. Earlier, we were joined by our Vienna correspondent, Homa Lezgi, for an update on the report. Let's take a listen.
But let's just have a quick look at what the main points of this update are. And in order to do that, we have to remember that on the 19th of January, Iran did inform the agency that it is no longer manufacturing parts for centrifuges, the rotor tubes or bellows at the Karaj workshop, which did come under a sabotage attack blamed on Israel, and was transferring that work to a facility in Isfahan. On the 22nd of January, the IAEA announced that it has dismantled its surveillance cameras in Karaj, and work on centrifuge parts there has actually stopped, and the IAEA has placed seals on the machines that are remaining there. On the 24th of January, the IAEA cameras were installed at the Isfahan facility. However, the IAEA did not and still does not have access to the information that's stored in these cameras because of the fact that this is tied to the fate of the JCPOA. According to Iranian law and according to an arrangement between Iran and the agency, the cameras are allowed to continue storing the information, but the agency would only have access to that information once the JCPOA is revived. So that's why the agency has said it cannot confirm whether Iran has started work at Isfahan, because, of course, it does not have access to the information that's been stored in those surveillance cameras. And the most recent update that this report contains is that on the 4th of April, very recently, Iran informed the IAEA that it is transferring all of the remaining machines at the Karaj facility to its Natanz enrichment site. And the IAEA, it's important here to note, the inspectors in this report, it's been confirmed, have verified that these machines are under seal and therefore they are not operating.
And Asia's stock markets slump after a sell-off in Wall Street over the U.S. Federal Reserve's planned monetary policy. Japan's Nikkei went down 2% and South Korea's Kospi fell 1.3%. Equities in Seoul, Taipei, Singapore, Wellington, and Manila were also all down. On Wednesday, stocks on Wall Street tumbled for the second day in a row, with the Nasdaq again losing more than 2% and the S&P 500 losing 1.5%. This came after it was revealed that the Federal Reserve is in favor of lifting interest rates 0.5% in its meeting next month. The measure is to rein in the United States' 40-year high inflation and prevent the world's largest economy from going into recession.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we discussed the importance of thanksgiving God, worshiping God, and remembrance of God. An essential way to worship God is to resist against satanic temptations which take us toward sins. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said to Imam Ali, peace upon him, that it is very difficult to be always in remembrance of God. True remembrance of God means that when the ground is set for committing sin, the individual fears God and does not commit sin. God has mentioned examples of those who kept aloof from sin for the sake of God. When the Egyptian chieftain's wife, Zuleika, solicited Prophet Yusuf, the latter refrained from the grave sinful act and preferred God's satisfaction to disgrace in this world and painful punishment of the hereafter. This was because of Yusuf's incessant remembrance of God. There are many ayahs in the Qur'an which warn us against satanic temptations. For instance, ayah 6 of Surah Fatir reads, "Indeed, Satan is your enemy, so treat him as an enemy." Ayah 27 of Surah A'raf also reads, "O children of Adam, do not let Satan tempt you like he expelled your parents from paradise." This heedfulness is remembrance of God. In the blessed month of Ramadan, God's servants refine their hearts through doing righteous deeds purely for God's sake. This way, they attain more blessings from God's banquet in this month. The attachment of the faithful to the Quran in this month and paying attention to religious instructions brings more spirituality to their life. Healthy spirits of individuals prevails in the society and makes the society healthy. The deeds of an individual are, in fact, the food of his spirit, since sicken the spirit and good deeds strengthen it. This will bring calm to human being. God says in Ayah 28 of Surah Rad, "Those who have faith and whose hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance, look, the hearts find rest only in Allah's remembrance." The human heart is related to his outward. For instance, if the eyes see something, the heart will seek it. One should control whatever enters his or her heart. The bodily organs are the gates of the heart. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "Whatever enters the hearts comes from two ways, the eyes and the ears." The Imam means that we should be very careful on what we listen to and what we look at. Being in close relation with the Qur'an is very useful for gaining spirituality, especially in the blessed month of Ramadan. The Islamic Iran every year promotes the Qur'anic culture through recitation of this book in mosques and holy places with scores of thousands of participants. Recitation of the Qur'an needs some preparations which have been recommended by religious leaders. One of them is ritual ablution. This helps the reciter of the Qur'an and the listener to gain more of its benefits. Ayah 79 of Surah Al-Waqi'ah reads in this regard, "No one touches it except the pure ones." However, the great servants of God, the friends of God, say that this purity has degrees, meaning that those who want to recite the Qur'an should have a mouth pure of sins. This will help the word of God enter the heart of the reciter. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, has also recommended the faithful to brush their teeth before reciting the Quran. This means that both outward and inward cleanness matter in Islam. Thank you. Dear listeners, according to the Prophet of Islam and his infallible successors, mere looking at the words of the Quran is an act of worship. Looking kindly at the face of the parents is also worship. Looking at the holy Kaaba is worship too. Looking at the faces of ulama is also considered as worship. Nevertheless, looking at the words of the Quran is very good, especially during the blessed month of Ramadan, provided that it is accompanied by contemplation. Ayah 204 of Surah A'raf reads in this regard, "When the Quran is recited, listen to it and be silent. Maybe you will receive Allah's mercy." This Quranic instruction has been mentioned by Imam Sadiq, peace upon him too. The Imam says, "Whenever the Quran is recited at your presence, it is obligatory for you to keep silent and pay attention to it." No doubt, familiarity with the teachings of the Quran does not end here. Recitation of the ayahs of the Quran and understanding their meaning are the first steps for putting into practice in the individual and social life. Ayatollah Khamenei says in this regard, "Beautiful recitation of the divine ayahs is the prelude for reflection of the Quran. We do not want to engage ourselves to make ourselves busy with recitation and reading the Quran and Quranic tones as a basic issue. This is the prelude. This is the course. Recitation of the Quran with sweet voice causes the human heart to get soft, to be humble, and to be prepared for understanding the Quranic teachings and Quranic ayahs. We need this."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Afghanistan Today. Part 2.
In 2010, the New York Times hinted at the collaboration between the U.S. Geological Survey and the Pentagon. The collaboration was to estimate the value of the mines in Afghanistan by using samples. This is the most prominent figure in the Pentagon, who was the commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East until 2010. General David Petraeus. As the highest-ranking U.S. military commander in Afghanistan, he had this to say about mines in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan is blessed with the presence of what are trillions, with an S on the end, trillions of dollars worth of minerals, if and only if you can get the extractive technology, the human capital operated, the lines of communication to enable you to get it out of the country and all the rest of that. Very big if, and of course there's a foundation of security that would be necessary on which to build all of that. But again, the prospects are very significant if you can achieve objectives.
There are many estimates about the value of mines in Afghanistan, from $1 to $3 trillion to dozens of trillions of dollars.
There's a figure floating out there that it's actually $3 trillion, and I've heard a figure of $30 trillion.
In 1998, Congress published a report on the vitality of mineral resources in Central Asian countries for the U.S. At the same time, the U.S.'s main problem was to transfer the oil and gas to the market. The U.S.'s ideal was to construct a pipeline in Afghanistan and transfer it to Pakistan and India to get access to high seas. India's Outlook news agency says Bush's main goal by attacking Afghanistan was pipeline politics. But after a while, with more investigation, it came to light that besides international transit, Afghanistan has some mines that are worth more than the mines anywhere else in Central Asia. Uranium, a strategic stone with vast resources in Afghanistan's Helmand province, where the U.S. and British troops were stationed in large numbers. Chromite industrial stone can be found in Khost and Logar provinces. Marble can be found in various parts of Afghanistan in large deposits, and dozens of other types of precious stones in Afghanistan. The bluest stone in the world is Badakhshan's azure, emerald in Panjshir, gold in Badakhshan, tourmaline in Kunar, chondrodite, quartz and various types of topaz, prosylite, aquamarine, and agate. After uranium, the next strategic mineral that Afghanistan has the biggest deposits in the world is copper. In our era, copper is more valuable because it has a basic role in renewable technologies like wind turbines and solar panels.
As the world electrifies, and whether it's moving towards green energy, whether it's solar or wind, what does that require? An enormous amount of copper. When you have every megawatt of wind power installed requires 7 tons of copper.
Since Eric Prince is involved in renewable energy's business, he knows well how vital the copper mines in Afghanistan are.
And if you build a mine, right, there's a place like Masainak. It's 50 kilometers south of Kabul. It's the largest copper deposit in the world, more than 6 million tons of copper. Do it manually. I'll employ 10,000 Afghans with picks and shovels and pay them $12 a day. The Taliban's paying 10, we pay 12.
I take great umbrage when people say, Eric Prince wants to privatize this and make money.
Yeah, I'm going to make money. I would try to make money.
Talc. The name of the mineral might not sound familiar to many people. The white material can be found in abundance in Afghanistan. Besides the wrong methods of extraction that can irreversibly damage the mines, the bitter reality is, based on a report by Global Witness in 2018, a large part of the talc mines in Afghanistan are in the hands of Daesh. The militant group has been mercilessly extracting and exporting talc and has achieved considerable financial resources. But where does the huge amount of talc is exported to? Global Witness published a report in 2016. Based on the report, almost all of the talc in Afghanistan goes to the U.S. and European countries via Pakistan. So the United States can indirectly benefit from the Daesh presence in Afghanistan because it can easily get inexpensive smuggled talc without having to foot any security bill. So it's easy to guess why the U.S. isn't serious about uprooting Daesh in Afghanistan. Talc is an important material for many industries, the plastic industry, paint industries, and ceramics. Talc is the main element in baby powder. The famous U.S. brand Johnson & Johnson is one of the biggest consumers of talc in the world. Peter Frankopan, British writer and researcher, explicitly tells us about the relationship between the talc used in baby powder and Daesh.
The relationship between baby powder and global world power. Can you expand on that sort of dilemma a little bit?
Talcum powder is the soft
powder known to mankind, right? And it's found, like lapis and like gold, almost exclusively in Afghanistan. And ISIS-K, which is sort of the Central Asian variant of ISIS-Daesh. So ISIS-K have been very effective in trying to work out what assets produce cash. And one of the things they've targeted are the talcum mines in Afghanistan. And that brings them estimates around about, Global Witness did the work on this, somewhere between $20 and $30 million a year minimum. And that's quite a lot of cash. That powder has come from probably ISIS-controlled territory, shipped out through Pakistan through legal or illegal.
Dasht e Nawar desert plateau in the Ghazni province. At the heart of the desert, there exists one of the most special needs of human beings today, lithium. Many people call it the oil of the 21st century.
Lithium in Afghanistan. So certainly the lithium deposits are not that common. These are salts that rapidly erode into the ocean. So finding them in on land is difficult. With the rise in the electronics industry, the need for lithium is only going to increase. And so you can imagine these are worth quite a bit of money.
Any electronic gadget that is charged and anything that has a battery needs lithium. The expansion of electric vehicles is something that has increased our need for lithium several fold. Eric Prince's engagement in the field of electric vehicles can be another reason behind his attachment to the mines in Afghanistan.
Working on a fund, a bigger investment fund, to do some of the strategic minerals that you need to make electric vehicles, right? There's a big shift coming in electric vehicles. Electric vehicles are coming.
The vast resources of lithium deposits in Afghanistan led to the realization of a prediction. Afghanistan became Saudi Arabia of lithium.
And the New York Times described it very, very well, calling Afghanistan the lithium country, the Saudi Arabia of lithium. So where Saudi Arabia is the oil capital of the world, Afghanistan will be the lithium capital of the world.
Jess Ventura, he was the governor of Minnesota from 1999 to 2003. He was an influential politician in most U.S. administrations and one of Donald Trump's old friends. In recent years, his revelations about the United States political system have caused controversies.
By the way, I now know why we're in Afghanistan.
Why is that?
A month ago, they announced it's got the biggest lithium deposit in the world.
For batteries?
Sure. Every cell phone, every computer, everything runs off of lithium. Cars are going to run off it. And we're still buying that we're there to fight terrorism and the Taliban? Give me a break. It's a red herring. The whole war on terror is just a red herring to get what they want to do. It's the lithium. What do you think we're there? Iraq's the oil.
The Technology Analysis Institute, VentureBeat, has a strange analysis. The future of Silicon Valley might become dependent on Afghan mountains. Silicon Valley is a region in southeast San Francisco, in California. It's considered the United States technology capital. This is the place where dozens of big companies like Tesla vitally need lithium.
Basically, extract the lithium from the ore.
In line with his strategy to get back the money spent in Afghanistan, Trump forced one of the world's biggest mining investors in the U.S. to go to Afghanistan. As the Wall Street Journal says, Trump push yielded copper and gold deals in Afghanistan. But who's the investor? He was one of the former CEOs of the American bank, J.P. Morgan.
J.P. Morgan.
J.P. Morgan.
J.P. Morgan.
J.P. Morgan is right now the biggest bank in the United States, probably the history of the United States. Right now, they're also the biggest bank in the world by market capitalization.
He's a banker and a mysterious character. There's no public or official interview with him. He's nicknamed the King of Mining. He's a British investor named Ian Hannam. He went to Afghanistan for the first time several years ago. In 2011, he established a series of chain companies for Afghanistan. The companies were mostly for research and experimental purposes. For several years, they extracted samples and studied the mines in Afghanistan. But after the years-long assessment based on the samples, there were rumors that the West was about to sign the biggest mining contract in Afghanistan. Badakhshan's gold and Belkhab's copper, with the prospect of creating 13,000 job opportunities and its $1 billion effect on the Afghan economy. But the contract was secretly signed in an unconventional way in Afghanistan's embassy in Washington. Ian Hanum was also present in the embassy, along with some Afghan political figures. The unconventionality of the contract led to rumors from the start. The New York Times reported there were legal concerns over the deal. Despite the ifs and buts, later on it was proved that the deal was just a cover. A year later, the contract was revoked. Politicization of the issue was one of the reasons mentioned for canceling the contract. Systematic corruption within the Afghan political structure and its dependence on foreign powers could be one of the most important reasons. But the more important question is, why Hanum didn't make a transparent investment in Afghanistan and only took samples and did experimental tests for assessment? The only thing that comes to mind regarding the issue is Eric Prince's close contact with Ian Hanum. Their relationship was clearly seen in natural resources and security issues in Venezuela. Ian Hanum canceled the copper contract in Belkhab and the gold contract in Badakhshan under circumstances that Eric Prince had launched his own project to privatize the war and mines in Afghanistan. Ian Hanum's documents and samples of the mines could give Eric Prince the best classified information, so he could start his mining activities in Afghanistan. It's only natural that Afghanistan needs foreign investment in its mining sector, but it become unnatural when it's handed over to the political mafia and foreign figures.
Well, there's no doubt that since the US invaded in October 2001, the war has been partly privatized, and the effect of that on civilian lives has been devastating. However, what Eric Prince is trying to do here is even worse. What he's trying to do is two things. One, privatize the war. He claims that thousands of private mercenaries can essentially do what the US military has not been able to do in 17 years of war. Prince has plans to try to exploit the country's resources. He has the Trump administration behind. He wants to try to exploit lithium and gold and rare earths in a diluted plan to be able to somehow profit, obviously, for his own company. It would worsen violence, not make it any better.
And in fact, as long as war and military occupation continue in Afghanistan, nothing will get better. Killing Afghan people by the U.S. forces turned into something ordinary. It makes news headlines every now and then. More than 102,000 Afghan civilians lost their lives from 2009 to 2019. During the 20-year occupation by the U.S. from 2001 to 2021, over 150,000 people in Afghanistan were killed. A considerable part of the crimes was committed by U.S. airstrikes. From 2007 to 2019, the U.S. dropped 20 bombs on the Afghan people every day on average. In 2019 only, it conducted 7,423 airstrikes on the country.
It looked like nothing was happening. Indeed, it looked like we were in a
all together now? Quagmire.
Sir, I was going to say stalemate.
Stalemate, yes.
These are familiar words, a stalemate from the past.
If you take a look at Afghanistan.
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 The United States of America is a friend to the Afghan people.
And end the war in Afghanistan.
Get out of Afghanistan.
And today.
My name's Joe Biden. I'm a Democrat.
What did you know?
Afghanistan, you said?
Yes, sir. Afghanistan.
That's it.
In a symbolic move, exactly in the room that Bush issued the order to attack, Joe Biden announced that U.S. military forces will completely withdraw from Afghanistan in 2021.
I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. Two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility onto a fifth. The United States will begin our final withdrawal begin it on May 1 of this year.
It is not clear, or maybe it is not important anymore, if he, just like his predecessors, says something in interviews and does something else in reality. The important thing is Afghanistan, which is riddled with so many questions. Definitely, any major development starts with asking questions. The questions arise from the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. Will we witness a different kind of U.S. presence in Afghanistan after it pulls out of the country and vacates the military bases? What should we expect if the speculations about the private security contractors going to Afghanistan are true? The people in Afghanistan have paid the most for the war. Will there be an end to their endless sufferings after the U.S. withdrawal? After 20 years of the Western country's military presence, it doesn't come as a surprise that Afghanistan is the saddest country in the world, according to the UN report in 2021. Will Afghanistan experience life differently, or will the vicious circle repeat? Only time will tell.
In the United States, the white net being cast by Justice Department prosecutors as they move beyond charging 6th of January rioters could encompass scores of potential witnesses from both inside and outside of government. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer, Luke Broadwater and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled Justice Department Investigation of 6th of January Confronts Sprawling Cast of Characters. Among the challenges facing the federal grand jury recently empaneled to investigate the 6th of January attack on the Capitol is the sheer number of people who might have information relevant to its inquiry. According to a subpoena issued by the grand jury, prosecutors are asking for records about people who organized or spoke at several pro-Trump rallies after the election. They presumably include two events in Washington in November and December of 2020, that preceded the gathering on the Ellipse near the White House on 6th of January 2021, where President Donald J. Trump told the crowd to descend on the Capitol. The subpoena is also seeking records about anyone who provided security at those events, and about those who were deemed to be VIP attendees. Moreover, it requests information about any members of the executive and legislative branches of the government who may have taken part in planning or executing the rallies, or tried to obstruct, influence, impede, or delay the certification of the presidential election. Each of these broad categories could involve dozens of individuals. Taken together, the total number of potential witnesses, or at some point targets, sought after by the grand jury could easily reach into the hundreds. The investigation appears to be in its early stages, and there is no way of knowing at this point where it may go, what crimes it might identify, or who it may ultimately focus on. Many people of interest to investigators might be called only as witnesses. One possible roadmap, at least in terms of who the grand jury may still want to hear from, is the parallel probe by the House Select Committee investigating the Capitol attack, which has already interviewed hundreds of witnesses, including on Tuesday, 5th of April, Ivanka Trump, the former president's daughter and advisor. A relatively small group of political operatives did the bulk of the work in organizing the pro-Trump rallies in Washington that kicked off after the election and sought to challenge the results, often using the slogan, "Stop the Steal." Prominent among them, according to interviews and documents, was Amy Kramer, a former Tea Party activist who helped create a group called Women for America First. The group set up a cross-country bus tour gathering Mr. Trump's aggrieved supporters behind the baseless assertions of a stolen election. Within hours of the last polls closing on Election Day, Amy Kramer started working closely with her daughter, Kylie Jane Kramer, to set up one of the first Stop the Steal Facebook pages. Both women were involved, often in close coordination with the White House, in planning pro-Trump rallies on 14th of November and 12th of December 2020, and then in setting up Donald Trump's appearance at their lips on 6th of January 2021. Two other people who helped Amy Kramer were Jennifer Lawrence and Dustin Stockton, both of whom had once worked closely with Steve Bannon, a former top advisor to Donald Trump. Another organizer for Women for America First was Cindy Shafian, who ultimately broke away from the group to form a new organization, the 80% Coalition, which planned its own event on 5th of January 2021. Then there was a separate group of planners around Ali Alexander, a provocateur who rose in right-wing circles after the election. Mr. Alexander, an associate of Donald Trump's longtime advisor, Roger Stone, was part of a group of activists who planned an event at the Capitol itself and marched with the crowd to the building after Donald Trump's speech at the Ellipse. Altogether, scores of people spoke at the rallies in November and December and at the gathering on 5th of January and 6th of January. They included people like Mr. Stone, Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and Alex Jones, the conspiracy theorist and host of the television show InfoWars. The speakers also included pastors, state-level politicians, and anti-vaccine activists. It is hard to know who prosecutors might consider a VIP from these events, especially for the November rally, often known as the Million MAGA March, and the one in December, which is sometimes referred to as the Jericho March. There were dozens of VIPs who attended Donald Trump's incendiary speech at their lips on 6th of January 2021, according to leaked documents from event organizers. That rally also featured appearances by Rudolph Giuliani, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, and John Eastman, the law professor who was promoting the idea that Vice President Mike Pence could block congressional certification of the Electoral College results. The attendees at their lips speech included Mike Lindell, the MyPillow chief executive who helped spread Donald Trump's lies about a rigged election, and the YouTube stars known as Diamond and Silk, who are prominent Donald Trump supporters. The federal grand jury subpoena examined by the New York Times seeks information about members of the executive and legislative branches of the government who might have been involved in the effort to delay congressional certification of the election results, suggesting that prosecutors are interested in learning more about the roles that Donald Trump's aides and allies inside the government may have played. It is not clear if any Trump-era executive or legislative branch members have received subpoenas, and there is no public indication that anyone has been targeted for prosecution. But in looking for more information about what was happening at both the White House and on Capitol Hill as Donald Trump sought to stay in power, the House Select Committee has already expressed interest in a range of White House and campaign advisors, as well as contractors who worked to set up the rally. They exist in concentric circles in and around Donald Trump's orbit. Among them is Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff under Donald Trump, who turned over text messages to the House Select Committee that served as a roadmap not just for his own activities, but those of others. He was one of the few people with Donald Trump as the riot at the Capitol.